Hello, and welcome to recording number 18 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated recording. I'm going to start here on page 127, paragraph 3. As the terrain began to be cut by gullies and the landscape rolled down towards the Yole River ahead, Gord turned on a more southerly course and spurred his horse to a canter so as to avoid being caught against the water. From what he had heard about this forest, Gord was none too comfortable traveling within its depths. The place was reputed to hide all sorts of nasty creatures and humanoid brigands, not to mention bandits said to infest the woodland. Perhaps these tales were the stuff used to keep small children at home, however, for the horseman on his tail had not hesitated in following when he had plunged into the trees, and a day of traveling amidst the forest had not brought him face to face with anything more fearsome than a smallish bear, and many small animals of the sort one would expect to encounter in such a setting. Near sunset, Gord led his steed through the shallow verge of a nasty-looking marsh that spread out to the west as far as he could see. Just as the swollen crimson orb of the sun sank below the horizon, he came out of the morass, remounted, and rapidly rode due south. This left the dangerous lowland far behind by the time full darkness swathed the trees in gloom. There would be no way for those who still might be at his heels to locate where he had left the marsh until daylight came. Gord dismounted and walked on warily, alert for danger, seeking a sheltered spot to sleep. A gleam of flickering yellow light alerted him that there were others ahead. Gord dropped his stallion's reins on the ground, patted the animal's neck, and told it in a whisper to remain silent until he came back. The courser seemed to understand, for it whickered softly, nodded its great head, and fell to searching for green growth amidst the tree roots. Gord crept stealthily toward the firelight. It was quite difficult to move silently, for the forest floor was covered with a scattering of dead leaves and dry twigs hidden by new growth. But Gord was adept at stealth. Only the faintest of sounds marked his approach to the source of the illumination. He was soon close enough to see that there were two small bonfires, and by their dancing light, Gord noted that some two dozen men, bandits judging by their dress and weapons, were scattered in the glen, preparing their food and readying for the night. They were a scurvy lot in motley armor and garb drawn from all nations and races, it seemed, for Gord saw several orcish and elvish half-breeds among them. On the far side of the encampment were six or eight horses. There were piles of goods near them, so Gord figured that the animals were used to carry captured spoils. This band must be returning to their base of operations, for the heap of stuff near the horses was sufficient to burden them all. Gord stayed in a crouch and began to creep slowly backward, for he had seen enough. Then a heavy weight fell upon his back, pinning him to the ground, and a sharp spear point pressed against his neck. "Don't move," a rough voice hissed. "One sound, and you're dead. Break." All right, now, Gord here is moving toward the Yole River, so we have another bit of terrain directions given. And then, as he's going on a southerly route, he's going through the Netherwood, I believe, and Gord is giving a brief description here of how, it's not considered a very pleasant place. It's got rumors of monsters and human brigands that are supposed to infest the wood, although he hadn't really come into contact with them yet. And then for Gord approaches this group of approaches these lights he sees, and encounters a group of brigands, who he assumes are brigands. And I find it interesting that he includes Orcish and Elvish half-breeds together in a kind of similar way, where I'd always assumed like the Orcish half-breeds were rough, where the Elvish half-breeds were more like, considerably like more like fantasy Elvish. But that's just like my loose interpretation of the setting. And perhaps a little too much Tolkien influenced in my idea, because here he's just seeing them both kind of like outcasts from their own societies. If if you're showing that, having that the half-elves and the half-orcs are being compared in a similar way.
Yeah, they're both in the outlaw band. Also, yeah, half-elves and Dragonlance are portrayed pretty well, too.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and I'd always kind of use them in a way like most elfin societies, where, other than the drow, you didn't really run into that many, directly evil elves. But I really think that, for the most part, Gygax is having them be, like the way that the city of Greyhawk is a rough place. I would, it seems like maybe every area is going to have its good and its bad, and not be tied down so much, like we have, like Selene might be overall a good country, but it'll have bad elves and good elves within it. And I get the feeling that elves in the Gygaxian campaign were not, he might have been trying to avoid that idea of the kind of classical Tolkien elf.
Right. He might be considering them more like the traditional fairy elves things to be put on a pedestal.
Yeah, like the Sidhe, who are probably saying that wrong, but who are like the elves that lived under hills, and you get taken and captured, and like in a lot of, I believe it's Irish mythology, the elves are considered to be a pretty bad group. And among the Norse, the people called elves, they were very much just like human beings. They were not, like these enchanted fairy creatures. The people we'd call dwarves were another one that they'd call elves as well. So here, I think Tolkien is maybe showing, at least with these half-elves, this mentioned that I think we could probably look at judging them more like a human than like, a classically, classic fairy or classic elvish kind of, more elite in a way, or more advanced in some ways. I think that's very interesting right there.
I don't even think the regular elves in Greyhawk are immortal, are they?
Oh, they're not. The longest lived ones are, I think it's the gray elves that lived over 1,000 years. There's, I think, some mention in one of the Book of Elves, which, that was one of the brown books, like the complete series. That the gray elves, after 500 years, went off to some immortal island or something, but they only lived 1,000 years. So there was some little Tolkienism there in that, but none of them were immortal. But they did have, the least of them had a much longer than human lifespan. Again, there's a little action here, but there really isn't too much to say. Now, near the Yol River, he mentions a swamp area. I'm not sure if that's, what that is on the map. But it does talk a little bit more about what the Netherwood would be like. And this encounter, I believe, should be in the Netherwood.
Yeah, the Yol kind of, it looks like it's on the western border of the Pale, and it cuts the bottom of the Faustwood off, and it looks like below the yawl is the Netherwood.
Yeah. Yeah, and that would make good sense there in the direction that Gord is traveling. I'm a little surprised. I found it amusing that he does mention move silently, which, of course, is the classic thief skill. But he does mention that, you know, the wilderness move silently is different from the way it would be, like, say, in the city. So you might want to have a thief have a penalty in wilderness trying to move silently for the first time till he learns how to move, because that silent movement would be more of a ranger skill than a thief skill in a forest, you know, because they're not used to moving through something as filled with bramble and trips. I'd say that since thieves have some stealth training like that, they'd be better than an average person. I just think that the move silently, that kind of ability would go more toward a hunter, a tracker, a ranger, and that a city thief like Gord would have to learn to be able to move silently. And then at the end here, not only ends up being surprised and captured, which is, you know, a little surprise in and of itself.
Oh, yeah, that's good, because up to this point, we don't see him have any kind of training in woodcraft.
Yeah, so I do like the fact that Gygax was thinking along the lines like, you know, Gord is leading the horse. It's even mentioned again here that Gord is leading his horse through the swampy areas and that the edges of the forest, and that these brigands, they're using those horses for transporting loot rather than riding, because it would be incredibly difficult to try to ride through a dense wood. And it would be very difficult to try to ride through a marshy area, because very easily for a large horse to, you know, injure its legs, or, you know, just be thrown off balance, you know, trying to move through an area where it can't even see where it's going to step. It makes so much more sense. And I'm glad that's reading through this, that it's a little bit of information that people can read this and then think about how they'd want to do it. Now, again, it's something that in a campaign you might just want to hand wave. But I think it does add a little depth to the campaign I don't really like this business where they have, like, well, you're in the village and it takes a day to travel to the dungeon and that's it. You know, I like it where a campaign where you might have encounters along the way, and things like not being able to ride the whole way, or you shouldn't because you're going to wear out your horse. That, I think, add something to the game, and I don't think it's very a pointless thing. I think it just makes it more than traveling from point A to point B. I think it adds the sense that you are traveling a distance, and a good thing to learn some stuff about how that travel would be, about how some skills are going to have to be fine-tuned, like the move silently, and also for this story, good that Gord isn't so you know, does have some things where he's not overpoweringly powerful just yet.
Yeah, he can't do everything.
Yeah. I do think he is, you know, kind of pushed, you know, a little beyond belief, but he is supposed to be not only an average adventurer, he's supposed to be a very, adventurer.
He's an exceptional character for sure.
Yes, yes. And, you know, that, you know, I mean, we can see that in his abilities of intelligence and dexterity. And, you know, he is an above average or an exceptional elite character. All right, I am going to restart here. It is chapter 14, page 129, the first paragraph. Gord stood weaponless before the bandit chieftain, guarded by the pair of sentries who had spotted him. Capturing him had been easy, and the two were smirking. Easy pickings were appreciated by their ilk, and Gord had furnished them with a surprising amount of loot. Evidently, he had been spotted when he first approached the encampment, and while two of the sentries crept up on him, another pair backtracked and found Gord's horse. The gold reliquary, a heap of coins, and his weapons were displayed on a cloak, his too, spread at the bandit leader's feet. "Why were you spying on us?" the big outlaw demanded. "To survive, one must be alert," said Gord evenly. "I was not spying, save to alert myself of any possible threat to my survival." "Well, chum, one didn't make much of a job of it, did one?" The bandit was mocking him, and Gord silently vowed that he would turn the tables at first opportunity. Then the man must have noted a defiance in his captive's eyes, for after a second he added, "A tough little one, ain't you?" That he stirred the pile of coins before him with the toe of his dirty boot, grinning down on Gord all the while, hand on his sword hilt. Gord stared back, but kept his gaze expressionless and neutral. "Good," the leader boomed. "I like guys with spunk. Tell you what I'm going to do. I lost some good men this raid, so the company is short-handed. If you can handle yourself, instead of killing you, I'll list you." Fellow paused and stared hard at Gord. Gord looked back but said nothing. "Okay, smartass. First you wrestle with Bogador," said the chieftain, pointing at a hulking brute Gord could see out of the corner of his eyes. "And if you survive that, you can have at Finn over there with quarterstaves." There were catcalls and sniggers from the assembled bandits at that. The chieftain laughed a bit too, but then shouted for silence and continued, "You don't really have to beat him, just survive. I'm giving you a break, but only because I'm short-handed. There are a fair bunch here, so if you make the grade, I'll even give you one share of the loot here, and you can keep your sword and knife." The bandit's tone was magnanimous, but if he expected Gord to thank him, the chieftain was wrong. "How about that dagger?" Gord inquired mildly. "I'm best with that weapon." "Sorry, chum," the big leader said as he picked up the blade. "I've taken a shine to it, but if you're real good in the tests, I'll give you my old one sometime." Gord shrugged. "No sense in arguing, is there? Where do I fight this Bogodope?" "That's Bogador," snarled a muscular half-orc as he moved fully into Gord's line of sight. "Come here, runt, and I'll show you who's a dope." With that, the bandits made a ring near the bonfire. Gord was shoved unceremoniously into the circle, even as he was stripping off his jerkin. Bogador was satisfied to have at it immediately. Gord skipped away from his first clumsy rush, managing to get his shirt off meanwhile. Now his lean, muscular torso was bare. His opponent would find no easy hold on loose garments. Bogador made another grab for him, this one less clumsy and more calculated. Again, Gord eluded the attack and circled. The ugly half-orc was not as stupid as he seemed. This Gord determined from the next couple of minutes of combat. Bogador was testing Gord's skills, and each time he attempted a move, he measured Gord's responses. Gord was measuring his opponent in return. Although rather slow and a bit uncoordinated, the half-orc was strong and his hands were huge. If Bogador ever got him in a firm hold, Gord knew that the fellow could break bones and would probably enjoy the process too. That mentality could actually work to Gord's advantage if he played things properly. It would not be the first time Gord had turned an opponent's aggression into victory, he thought, recalling for an instant his duel with Zoltan. This match, however, was trickier than it first appeared. If Gord was crippled, then he'd be useless and slain out of hand. If he seriously injured Bogador, Gord knew that at best he'd have the undying enmity of the half-orc, and whatever friends the fellow had, the score would be evened with a knife across his throat one night. Killing him would make Gord's position that much worse. His only option, Gord realized, was to somehow win without beating Bogador badly, without himself being injured and unable to face the test of staves. One thing at a time, he cautioned himself, as the half-orc bandit managed to grab Gord by his left arm. Gord flipped out of the grip before Bogador could lock it into a hold, and he delivered a painful kick to the bandit's stomach in the process. Gord was still in the fight, but now the half-orc had a far better idea of what his small opponent could do. Bogador advanced cautiously now. Encircling outlaws gave shouts of encouragement mixed with demands for Gord's dismemberment. The half-orc feinted at a leg grab with his left hand and then swung his ham-like right in a looping uppercut, which, although it just grazed Gord's chin, was sufficient to send him sprawling. Off-balance, Bogador flopped down upon Gord with sufficient force to knock the wind out of him. But fortunately, it took the brute a couple of seconds to get into a position where he could utilize his advantage. In that time, Gord managed to recover his breath and clear his head sufficiently to counter. As Bogador grabbed Gord's hair with his left hand and brought his right forearm down, aiming for his pinned opponent's throat, things shifted. By hunching, Gord managed to both protect his neck and get into a position where his jaws could lock on the beefy arm, trying to crush his windpipe. As he bit the brawny arm with all his strength, Gord slammed his open right palm into the underside of Bogador's jaw. The blow jerked the half-orc's head back with a snap, although the bandit's thick neck muscles prevented any serious harm. This combination of bite and blow caused the bandit to blink, then howl in pain and rage. Even as he bellowed, another attack was already causing him further difficulty. Gord had caught the fingers tangled in his hair, wrapped his hand around one of the digits, and bent it back toward the breaking point. At the same time, Gord used his left hand to grasp the huge right fist of the arm he was biting, trying to pull it to Gord's left and away from the area of his throat to relieve some of the pressure on his chest. These actions were more than sufficient to make Bogador move. His efforts to stop the jaws from clamping on his arm while maintaining his attempt to choke Gord, prevent a breaking of his finger, and still remain atop his adversary at the same time, turned out to be disastrous for him. Leverage on the half-orc's right arm forced Bogador to roll sideways when he attempted to pull his left hand away from Gord's hold on it before the finger snapped. Gord helped the situation further by bringing his right knee up sharply as Bogador's weight was removed from that leg. The blow didn't impact with real force on the half-orc's groin, but the grunt he made when it hit told Gord that it hurt plenty. As the bandit's weight moved off him entirely, Gord used his acrobatic skills to arch his back and spring erect. As the bewildered Bogador struggled to his feet, Gord spat blood at him and mocked him through reddened lips. "What's the matter, Bogodope? You only able to wrestle old men and cripples. Or maybe you like tussling with little boys." His eyes red, Bogador let out a howl of rage. He lost all plan of attack, wanting only to grab Gord and crush him to a bloody pulp. There wasn't much room to maneuver within the circle of bandits, but Gord could leap. He somersaulted directly into the half-orc's rush. His feet came up just as Bogador's big belly arrived at the same place. The force of Bogador's charge easily reversed the momentum of Gord's roll, and with his back firmly resting on the ground, stiff legs acted as a lever to lift the charging bandit off his feet, even as inertia continued to carry him forward. Gord used his own strength to assist the bandit on his way, and Bogador, wind driven from his body by the belly kick, arced over Gord's head and came down with a jarring thud nearly 6 feet from where Gord now stood. The half-orc didn't move. The onlookers were stunned, Ogador was the strongest of their number, and he'd been beaten by a young fellow half his size. There were a couple of grudging words of congratulation from the group, and someone slapped Gord on the back. Ogador was now coming round, and already a few jibes were being aimed his way. Gord stood silently poised. He looked at the bandit with no expression as Bogador slowly got to his feet. The half-orc stared at him a moment, shook his head, and then shot Gord a half-grin. "For a little smart-ass punk, you fight good," the brute said. "Go at it again someday soon." Break. All right. A big action scene, and we get to see how weaponless combat, might be, be worked out. And definitely, even though Gord is, at this point, it seems an experienced thief with warrior training, in his weapon skills, in hand-to-hand, he's good, but he's not necessarily as good as he is with weapons and it kind of is a near thing. Gord is knocked down, and he does use the acrobatic skills in combat here to show that it's increased also his fighting ability, these learnings and the things he's learned from the Atloy here.
Yeah, it's good that he's using that, because he's a lot smaller than Bogador.
Yes, it really it's also a campaign way. Again, if you need to think of ways to describe the hand-to-hand combat, again, much more interesting for the DM to and the player to talk about certain moves they're using and role play it as much as possible. And that's always better than, you grapple and roll the dice and you swing and hit, miss. It's always more interesting to have combat with a little more, flavor text to it. And also, if I always try as a DM to reward players who do think about the combat, and it is a quick reaction kind of thing, but you have to think, what are you going to do in this combat? And if they do try something more than just say, want to roll the dice for it, I do encourage that and give them, extra damage or, extra experience for learning this kind of combat or fighting combat in a more interesting way. But here there isn't much as far as anything other than those kind of ideas. As an action scene, there's a couple pages past here, and it is not really full of anything. We hear about Bogador, and we also get the reaction to this group of bandits, where the bandit chief wants to enlist Gord, but only if he's able, it looks like, only if he's able to really hold himself up. And here, Bogador is supposed to be the strongest out of all the group, if not entirely the most experienced.
Yeah, that's a big challenge for somebody that they just found, spying on them in the forest.
I think the other thing is that probably the kind of weapons and the loot that Gord's holding, it might speak to the fact that Gord is a thief himself rather than like a merchant. And I find it interesting, though, that the bandit chief takes an immediate... again, it's this business of the more experienced, the better discernment you have. Because there's no mention that the long tooth is a magical dagger. He never gets to use it. But the chief immediately takes a liking to it. It was supposed to be a good-looking dagger with runes carved on it and everything, the long tooth. But at the same time, it is this matter of people being able to have this extra discernment that I keep noting, where the more experienced people, like Clyde the Sharper, they can pick out things that are hidden to other people. And that talks of experience Clyde is on the lookout for somebody like Gord, you know, who's going to try something like that back at the beginning when he was disguising himself as being too sick to get himself assigned to that lowest class of people held in the workhouse.
Well, here's another reason why Gord was smart for not picking a dagger that illuminated, right? Because if the captain or, you know, the leader of that crew, the boss, pulled a dagger and saw it light up, he would instantly have known it was magic.
Yes. I mean, and then, you know, that's the other thing. You're in, say you're, so much of Gord is stealth rather than direct action, disguise and stealth, that having something that immediately points, you know, picks you out, like if he's in a dark dungeon, and say he wants to, he's one, you know, he, as a thief in the gameplay, his biggest advantage in attack is the backstab. You know, and here he's got a good magic weapon for a backstab. And if it lights up, I mean, it really defeats that purpose of stealthy attack. So, yeah, all those weapons, that's, you know, immediately, and it's funny, that's immediately what Gygax thought of. I like, there's little things here that says, like, twisting the fingers back is a classical hand-to-hand combat technique. So, he is trying, Gygax does know a little about, you know, probably read stuff about hand-to-hand combat, and he was a war gamer, although there wasn't much in the way of, you know, tactical war gaming at the time where you would have individuals doing the fighting. Yeah. But that was actually development of Chainmail, the earlier game where they were doing what would be called like a skirmish game where the individual miniatures represented single characters. Where in the larger scale wargaming, individual miniatures might represent, you know, 5 or 10 or more individuals in that one miniature. All right, the language is still a little bit early 20th century, like smartass punk, and there were some other comments made by the bandit chief that reminded me of a little Edward G. Robinson. I was just rereading this Gizmodi review of Saga of Old City, and there were points he made in that were I wouldn't argue with, but it's just somebody who really did not like or know anything about Greyhawk and did not recognize that the campaign is being fleshed out here. But again, if you don't have familiarity with Greyhawk and the original campaign, then you're probably used to being having everything spelled out for you. And I know that reviewer complained about, you know, the Tharizdun module, the later the Temple of Tharizdun, that there wasn't enough, you know, text dialogue. And it's complaining. He felt that needed more description of what was going on. Whereas what Gygax, you know, I believe did was, if you came into combat, like say you were in his campaign and there was hand-to-hand combat, he would start describing to you what he wrote here. And that you only needed a few prompts, like you needed to know, maybe write down how many bandits there were and something about some individual characters. Yeah, there's the glowing Cambion there.
Did the guy consider that it was Gary's first attempt at writing a novel and he didn't necessarily have a great editor?
No, I mean, there was a lot of mistaken beliefs. I think the biggest thing was that he wasn't either. He wanted to appear very modern, or he is very modern thought, and that he was kind of set back by... you know, there's a lot of commentary in here. It's the characters are not, you know, not wonderful characters. And I think he's maybe looking for books where the hero is heroic and that the villains are perhaps not as villainous as they are in, you know, in the Gord book, or that, like, the City of Greyhawk shouldn't be as You know, because it's a very harsh city. Mm-hmm. And what's funny is if you read the back of the cover, the very first thing it says is Greyhawk, a beautiful, wondrous city, a cruel city, a harsh, pitiless city for a young orphan boy. And it's like that is one of the key things. It encompasses more than just the entire campaign encompasses more than just, you know, the straightforward, this is a good city, everybody acts good. Now, this is actually, you know, it's very interesting here that the bandit chief, and if you look at Bogador's reaction, Bogador doesn't really have any animosity here. You know, I think he would have easily killed Gord if he got the chance, but all of this doesn't seem to be have any anger. He gives Gord a little smile, a half grin, and you know he compliments him. He says, "You fight good," and you know, all in all, these bandits, they seem to be pretty accepting, you know, of this person that they've just robbed, and are looking at having him join them.
They remind me of friends of mine who used to get drunk and fight each other. I don't know why they did it, but
it's a more rough society, and it's right. I think it's something that you know, people who've never been part of any of that, like, may not have been in, you know, this reviewer may not have been in any real kind of harsh situation in his life, and may not have any idea that the world is the way it is. It seemed like a very naive review of the thing, and even for a reviewer not to recognize that who says that he didn't you know anything about Greyhawk, and then it's not to recognize and the complaint that there was no overarching theme in this first book. And this first book takes Gord from 12 on up. This is a book about Gord and events in life, especially for an adventurous sort. It's not like he ended up joining, was an accountant, you know, who went to work every day, or even a craftsman.
This is a beggar thief, not a paladin.
Yeah. And, so anyway, that I think is, that was really struck me. But here, right here, we do see, you know, a good campaign idea that, like, one of the things I would do is, I had a campaign where the first level characters ran into a dragon. And what the dragon did is the dragon enslaved them all and had them working for the dragon, you know, sorting out his hoard of silver and gold and, doing various things for the dragon, you know, and it was done in a half humorous way. And what the, when the dragon left one time, the adventure was that they had to escape, from the dragon's lair. And that was, it wasn't that they were going to fight the dragon. It was that they were going to be put in this situation. And anyone who wanted to fight the dragon would be, you know, first level character could be easily killed, and they knew that. So there was a threat if the characters, players acted the wrong way. So here we have that an idea that you'd have the bandit gang, and that it could just be an opportunity for adventure rather than the end of the game in itself. And we can see that even though Gord is good at things, here there are a group of bandits. Very unlikely for Gord to be able to survive as an individual, beggar thief, acrobat thief, to survive in a fight against them, especially when they get the drop on him. So, you know, Gord usually does do the smartest thing. And in this case, where he does look defiant at the chief, that turns out to be a positive for him, because the chief even says that he likes somebody with spunk. So if Gord had been whining and like he did for Theobald, it probably would have gotten him killed.
I mean, I think we have historical, or maybe not historical, but in fiction, when Robin Hood met Little John, didn't they fight?
Yes, exactly.
Little John won, and then Robin said, "Hey, join the band."
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing, is that, you know, the very first thing, and then here, the next section, we're supposed to get a quarterstaff fight. And in a sense, This is very kind of Robin Hood. And I know that one of the earliest Robin Hood stories that I read was in Ivanhoe, you know, where Robin Hood makes an appearance in Ivanhoe. And he is not the Robin Hood of later fiction. He is not an Errol Flynn Robin Hood. He is definitely more like a bandit Robin Hood.
Is he still Robin of Locksley, or?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's the general story that they used in the Robin Hood movies and stories, okay, except without the Ivanhoe character, where with Ivanhoe, the king has been kidnapped and they're raising funds for him and stuff. But it's a little bit different in the Ivanhoe tale. But again, that's that there is a Robin Hood and an encounter. And then, like we said, with Little John gets in the quarterstaff fight with Robin Hood. Then I forget if the story or the movie, that they both dunk each other, you know, on that.
In the movie, for sure, they dunk each other in the movie.
Yeah, and there, in that sense, although Robin Hood is a warrior, he is much smaller. So this is kind of like a combination encounter of Little John, where we have the big half-orc and then the next person, Finn, who is supposed to be good with quarterstaffs.
I never read Ivanhoe. Maybe I should.
It is a great story. It is a great story. I would say if you get a chance, again, it's I think obviously that that here, I don't know if he's read it or whether he's just reflecting off of the more popular Robin Hood, but I really think this encounter is inspired by that situation to an extent.
Does sound like it.
All right, I'm going to restart here. It is page 133. We are on paragraph 5. Before anything else could be said, the chieftain stepped in and grabbed Gord by the shoulders. "Not bad, chum, not bad," he said with a tinge of admiration in his voice. "But you're not through yet. Finn here wants to show you a thing or two about handling a stick." Finn was a rangy fellow, half a head taller than Gord, and he wore the quilted padding used both to prevent chainmail from chafing and to help protect its wearer. Such gear would be a tremendous boon in a match with quarterstaves, and Finn's expression showed he was well aware of his advantage. Gord knew he was in real trouble now. Watch Finn spin and shadow fight with his iron-shod staff. It was soon going to be apparent to everyone that Gord was completely inexperienced with such a weapon. Finn certainly needed no protection from any attack Gord could mount with a quarterstaff. All the young man knew about billets like this was using them to assist in balancing or for vaulting. The contest would be over quickly, and Gord could only hope that he wasn't crippled or killed in the sure-to-be-painful process. A new arena circle formed, and the bandits began cheering and calling out once more. Gord was handed a heavy staff, but again shoved forward, the ring close behind him, and Finn stood facing him, on guard with his quarterstaff. Both men stood motionless for a couple of seconds, staring into each other's eyes. Suddenly, several shrieks rang out from the circle of outlaws. Gord saw with shock that a crossbow bolt had suddenly sprouted from the chest of a man across from him. Another missile had left a scarlet trail across Finn's cheek. Gord immediately threw himself to the ground, instinctively wondering why he hadn't heard the angry buzz of the bolt that hit Finn. Its flight certainly must have come close to his head. Already, two or three of the bandits were down, flopping or dead, and the others were wounded. Nevertheless, they were tough fellows, and their response was immediate. It took only seconds for them to recover from the surprise of the unexpected hail of quarrels. Then they were running, dodging, crouching, scattering. A At the same time that Gord was moving into a crouch and preparing to defend himself somehow with the staff, weapons were unsheathed or grabbed, and the encampment was nearly ready for a counterattack against the missiles, when six mailed horsemen thundered into the clearing. Though the cannon's hounds were still after him. Bolts still flew through the air, even as the riders cantered towards the bandits with leveled lances. More bandits were slain or wounded by these missiles before the sharp lance heads bit home. As a lancer thundered past where Gord was crouched, he stabbed the thick quarterstaff between the horse's legs. The animal neighed in pain and stumbled forward, tail over the head. The rider was thrown down, rolled upon by the horse, then thrust through with a spear from his intended target. A bolt took the bandit in the leg, and he in turn fell to the dirt. Gord rolled for cover in the shadows, searching frantically for some weapon with which to defend himself. Already about half of the bandits were dead or seriously wounded, and only two of the lancers were down, at least one done for certain. Four still atop their steeds had discarded their long weapons in favor of sword and axe. Several more of the outlaw band fell, but one of the horsemen was struck full in the chest by a flail. The soldier had hardly hit the ground before two bandits fell upon him and finished the work. Here, chum, the words reached Gord just as a blade, his own dagger, buried itself in the tree trunk beside his head. The thrower was the chief of the company of bandits. Gord was grateful for the gesture, and also pleased that the fellow didn't seem to notice how far the dagger had sunk into the tough bronzewood bowl. As Gord tugged the weapon free with difficulty, the leader called out to him again. "It ain't much. You better be good with it, 'cause we're up to our ass in alligators." With that, the chieftain darted beyond the clearing, probably aiming to stop the sniping crossbowmen from doing further bloody target practice. Break. Again, we have an action scene, but here we have a little picture by Clive Caldwell of Gord's enchanted dagger and showing its power by embedding itself deeply in a bronzewood tree. The bronzewood is one of the Greyhawk's campaigns. Unique bit of trees, and so it's something we don't know much about yet, but we're told that it is a much tougher kind of tree than a normal one of normal wooden bark. Gord is saved here at the last minute from being beaten senseless by that quarterstaff, but that again shows that you need some kind of weapon proficiency. Now, I'm not a big skill person, but I do like the idea that you're going to, like what character should be doing, like in between going to and from adventure, is maybe learning different weapons.
Gord is, but not that one.
Oh, and, I wouldn't say that you'd have the ability to become skilled in every weapon, but the truth is there that a lot of people today who are learning weapons, hand weapon skills, they do become like various people. They learn every kind of bow, every kind of crossbow. They learn, a lot of different weapon training. And I think there is a thing where everybody should try to, within reason, learn the most weapons that they can, so they're not completely, inexperienced with them. And I don't think it would... See, that's one of the reasons I dislike the skill system, because, familiarity with something can come just so that, you can learn to wear armor, you can learn, and it doesn't take the amount of time that it might take you to go from one level to another to be able to pick up enough familiarity with, knife fighting and with sword, or with for most common weapons, to at least not be completely untrained with them. And I do believe there should be a big disadvantage, like Gord is foreseeing, since he doesn't know the quarterstaff at all. That should be a big disadvantage for him.
I'm sure he would have gotten hurt in that fight.
The other thing is that, you know, like with armor's the same way. If you've never practiced with a shield, you know, there's even learning how the proper way to hold it, even if you're just using the shield to block. So, you know, there should be a disadvantage to being completely unskilled. But I really think in an RPG that if you had people who's of whatever class who wanted to learn various things like what kind of armor to wear and stuff, I really don't think there should be a reason, story-wise, role-playing-wise, to keep them from it. And I dislike gaminess, where you're keeping them doing it because you don't want them to have the same advantages as another character. To me, that doesn't make any sense. You know, I don't see why you should try to force, you know, some kind of reality out of the game to satisfy this business, supposedly for, you know, like balance. Because I've always believed that the balance is the DM, and that the situations, you can run into any situation. And you have to know when to stand up to a fight, and you have to know when to, you know, just scream, run away, and everybody retreat. Or you have to accept the fact that sometimes characters are going to lose. And here, Gord starts off losing, and he's captured. But it doesn't mean that he's going to be killed out of hand. And, like we said, we look at Robin Hood, and you don't necessarily have to have every fight end in the death of the character. And, you know, I mean, in this world, kidnapping's a big, real possibility. So we could have Gord have maybe even just said, well, don't kill me because I've got more treasure hidden away, and I'll lead it to you to the treasure. And, you know, there's all kinds of things that could be done in this situation to keep it being from the character just being killed off, you know, right off the bat. Now, looking at that picture, it's, you know, I don't know that we can use that as a depiction of the Bronzewood tree, which is, you know, looks a little diseased to me. And we don't, I think, have a good description of it anywhere else. The dagger doesn't quite fit the look of what was described. And it is shown, I believe, back with a Hengel. It does have, the dagger. I'm not sure both of them look the same.
Are we sure that the dagger in Hengel's hand is the one that Gord wound up buying?
That's a very good point. He was shown several. We can't tell if it glows. We can't tell if it was the black metal dagger that had the pits. No, that's true. We can't say that Hengel is actually holding the long tooth that Gord ends up getting. Now here, the oddest thing I find in this is that those horsemen, kind of silently approach. And also that in forest, even this is a clearing, that they're able to ride out from the woods and engage them with lance. And I would think the lances, I just think, well, no, it, no.
It could be it.
It could be it. It actually does look quite a bit like it. I'm wrong. It's, you know, the hilt looks the same, the little mark on the blade. That looks the same. No, I'm wrong. That does look enough like it. That could be exactly the long look of the long tooth. There's again, this is a big action scene. We get a little bit about the quality of the bandits, that they're fairly tough, and that it isn't, we don't know how good these soldiers are. There should be a dozen of them who followed Gord. And it looks like six are on horseback and six are using crossbows to shoot at the various bandits. There are a number of bandits because immediately they bring two or three down and wound others. And then Gord in the fight is describing several that are killed in the bandits being killed in the fight. And again, the other thing would be that these bandits have, the bandits don't appear to be armored. You know, at least much more than like leather, padding. padded armor, while the cannon soldiers, they all appear to be in mail. I do find it odd that they are able to have followed Gord. There could be a lot of reasons for that. But that they're able to Gord is captured, moving stealthily toward the bandit camp. There is the distraction of the fight going on. But then that the bandits, they're smart enough to set out guards when they're there with a fire blazing in the forest, but they're not smart enough to have a few people on guard when there are other people, the rest of the bandits are distracted by the fight. So, I mean, it's not outrageous, but I just think that horsemen moving through the woods would be loud enough for most people to, have heard.
Especially at night, right?
Woods are not necessarily quiet at night, but they're quieter than you get because, most woods should have should not be silent unless there is something that is frightening, the population. It's most of the sounds are going to come from birds, but there's also insects and various. Some frogs are particularly loud, so there's a lot of things that happen in a wood at night where it is not a perfectly silent environment, but it is the time for most predators to be out, and so most prey shuts up.
I was thinking that the challenge of riding through a forest at night would probably make people unfamiliar with a wood make a lot of noise unless they saw a path.
Yeah, I mean, now obviously there should be some kind of pathway to this clearing, and it may be a pathway that they've used many times, and they have brought their own horses. So there are 8 horses that the bandits brought, loaded down with gear. And most forests are not impenetrable. The big danger is that animal trails are circuitous. They're not usually straight. They're going to curve around things for various reasons. And the way that a wild forest is the growth of the trees is not regimented. It's they grow wherever there is sunlight to have them. And then there's going to be a lot of bracken. And the kind of things that would grow beneath a normal forest would be brush, a lot of things to tangle, and it would depend on kind of the trees where tree roots are exposed and the lower branches. So trying to make your way through dense wood, I cannot see, and at nighttime, can't see how these soldiers from Redmond would be able to do it without some kind of magical device or special training like as rangers. But even then, I just think a ranger wouldn't be riding through a forest at night. He'd be leading his horse. And the bandits were leading there. So I do find that. And then to be able to get the horses fast enough for a charge, that, when you do a charge with lances. Now, a lance is handy. You can do a lot of long-distance jabbing. And from horseback, it's a big advantage against someone on the ground, to have that extra reach. And, lances are particularly deadly with the momentum of, if your rider has stirrups, then you can brace yourself against the horse and gain the strength of its momentum into your thrust, or with the lance. But to ride out into just suddenly come crash, there it should be like crashing through the bushes, through the dense growth here. Mm-hmm. And I would say it would have made much more sense if there were 12 men with crossbows, or just the men with crossbows start the attack and then have the rest of the men approach with, the handheld weapons and off horseback. I found that just kind of, that's just a technical thing. I just think that Gygax loved history and he loved learning about combat, and he's talking about these various things that he really does know different about weapons and has read things. I just, from my own reading experience, I would just say that it seems unlikely that you would have horsemen unfamiliar with the woods in dense woodland be able to ride at night without getting the horse tripped, breaking a leg or getting knocked in the face or the body by a branch, which, you know, if they're riding through and they ride at a branch that's at, you know, head level, it could, you know, knock them right off the horse.
Easily.
So I just don't see it. And then at the very least, any lower branches are going to be snapping as a full horse and rider try to get through.
Yeah, there could be holes and rocks and the horses could fall.
Yeah, and it's like I was saying with the swampland, that even during the day, you can't ride a horse. You could ride a horse through water, and especially deeper water is easier because the horse isn't just walking across, it's floating across. But if the horse cannot see where it's putting its feet, you know, if it's very unsure footing, then a horse will balk, at doing it. And in a swamp where the heavy weight of the horse is going to be causing it to sink down, and where the density of the ground might be, you know, from one place to another, might be different from every footstep.
It'd be quicksand. And,
yeah, and or just as simple as, here there's some stone under this area, and then over a foot later there's no stone. And the muddy earth in the swamp would not support anything unless there's some bedrock under it or fallen trees and bowls of stuff. It's just the rider would dismount, go ahead to lead the horse to make sure the horse doesn't trip. And so, you know, it's just why there's areas where, open plain, that's great for horses, but going through dense forest and the swamp. So I'm a little surprised by that.
Yeah, and these guys, like you said, they're not rangers. If anything, they're cavaliers or paladins of Foltis, I would think. I mean, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
That's not revealed.
I would think that maybe there's one leader, and maybe a leader and a sub-leader, but, they split into three. You know, there were 36 of them. They split into three groups, and so there would probably be an overall leader and maybe a lieutenant kind of thing, and somebody like a sergeant or a corporal, the equivalent, and maybe not called that, but somebody with that level of experience, somebody who was part of the leadership, and somebody who was like leader of the more common troops.
If a decision had to be made as to which way to go, there would be somebody who would have the definitive ability to say, well, we're going right and we're left or whatever.
That person would probably be, if they had a ranger or a paladin or a cleric who were leading this group. And just the way things go, it would be kind of luck of the draw which one would follow Gord as they split into three groups. So,
those guys could have been had magic on them, too. I just thought of that.
That, of course, is one of the things about a fantasy book, is magic does throw everything into, and they're tracking that reliquary. So, there may be a way for them to know where that holy, item is.
Oh, true.
So, yeah, the only thing that I kind of object to is just I don't think any magic that would make it easier to go through, because it would be hard to go through a forest in the day.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking that. I wasn't thinking that it would make it easier. I just thought it would enable them to move quietly.
Well, that is true. They might have something, like the cleric that doesn't. I'm trying to think offhand. There's a silence spell, and they may be under some kind of enchantment like that. And who knows what the canon was able to prepare them with, and who accompanied them, because although they're described as men at arms, they may not all be men at arms, and they could easily be led by an armored cleric.
Right.
We're at 7:04.
Oh, wow.
And although we've covered a certain amount of ground here, because there's a great deal of action description, there's still, like we're talking about, there is enough to bite into here, but nothing, as far as Although we heard about this as the Yole River and some description of the Netherwood, again, this was pretty light in the campaign geographic descriptions or ideas about, you know, kingdoms and towns and villages and place names. But again, there's a lot of things to pull out of this, and especially looking at this coming from Gygax, and who is writing this with the idea that it isn't just, it is the fantasy game turned into fiction. So we can look at this, and in a way, it does have to follow the AD&D rule system for it to make sense in that respect. And so there is a lot to gather, even from these action sequences, that we can translate easily back into gameplay. I'm going to have to shut down. This is the end of recording 18. You can find the archives on the Cannon Fire website. I believe it's recordings 1 to 16 are up. Either there or here on the Greyhawk Fiction text channel on the Cannon Fire Discord here, you can feel free to comment. Even if you don't want to speak, you can just write in comments. And hopefully down the road, we're going to see a text area underneath the recordings, and you'll be able to comment there, and maybe we can revisit certain recordings and sections to answer some questions about, you know, that may have not been answered in the commentary, or point out things that, you know, that we have missed. All right. Good night.